Symposium, and I spoke to Dave and some others, and Andrew said he would be of any help he could. And I said, well, I'd love to have you as a speaker. You are the preeminent scientist in phosphorus. I had been visiting Dr. Camprath once many years ago, and he expressed his admiration for the research you were doing and how you handled yourself as a person. And I thought that was very appropriate for you to make a presentation on how Dr. Camprath may have influenced your career. So please come up, and glad to have you.
Thank you. It's a privilege, honor to be here to be able to talk about Dr. Camprath, Gene, or Dr. K, as you, as David mentioned. And I'm going to just go through a little bit about some of the impact that he's had professionally and personally, and then some of the legacy of what I see or where we've come since we were working with him. And I think I'm kind of reiterate what has already been said with Jim and David, that my first recollection, I think, was at one of the meetings, and I did have the opportunity, as I was talking Pedro last night, that I did visit him over in North Carolina, but the first impression was this was a quiet gentleman that was a gentleman, and that's all I could say. Basically, that sums it up. And I've been around a lot of other people, Keith Sires and others that were more outgoing, Malcolm Sumner, and along I started to meet Gene, and there was this totally different person, and it was just somebody that instilled this confidence in you. And I think the things I got were, as you already mentioned, and I started to look through the papers and some of it, and there was never very one or two sole authored papers, but most of them were teams. And it was just, I think one of the things I realized from him was this idea of the group was bigger than the individuals. And that was always the case, and I think that's some of the things I've learned. But I also learned, and I think either going to meetings and meeting him, that he was fairly quiet, but once he started to speak and ask you questions, I quickly realized I've got to be thinking about what he's saying and then, you know, have coming out a response. And so he was a very thought-provoking type of a person. And so with that, I just wanted to kind of go through a little bit of what I've seen and where it came from and how it fits in. And in terms of phosphorus, we have stories about, well, we've got too much and there's an issue. Well, obviously that's not a case, and we know that from Gene's work, and I'll show you that in a minute. But we still do require phosphorus for a majority of soils in the U.S. and globally. And so it's this idea of appropriate fertilizer applications, and so that's kind of changed a little bit. One of the things that we found is, you know, that he was looking to see how much fertilizer was needed in soils, but what we also now know that it doesn't take much of that phosphorus once it's in soil to get into water to be a concern. And then that has changed over the last 20 years, where we've seen you know some freshwater concerns, and it's got public attention. It's got attention in Toledo. It's got in the Chesapeake Bay, hypoxia in the Gulf, wherever. That there's not much. It goes a long way in terms of phosphorus, and so it's kind of transformed a little bit the research that Gene, Dr. Camprath started. And I think one of the things that we always try to take home when we give these talks to or explain these types of things, and I know some in the audience have been involved talking to farmers, Chesapeake Bay and other areas, they get a little bit upset and say, why are you're persecuting us about this phosphorus? And once you let them know this is not particular to you, it's a global issue, it's not just picking on one little area, it starts to resonate a little bit. And again, that's, again, part of that comes from Gene and his work around the globe. And so I guess one of my first interactions, and we call this the Gold Book. I'm sure a lot of you know it, and it was just generally called the Gold book, and it was the phosphorus book, and that's where we learned everything about phosphorus, and it was done in 1980. And as I worked more, I got the opportunity to work with ARS when phosphorus probably wasn't fundable, but we had the money at that time to work on things that we felt were important, as opposed to having a big impact. And so it allowed us to do some work. And so in about 25 years later, we updated that, and you know, based a lot of what was in that original book by Camprath and Watson, to update that, to put it into a new context, but also just refocusing on some of the things that were in that he already had in there in that original book that he had edited. And so that was, again, that was a product that I think that's more recent, it's a little bit more broader, but it certainly does go back to the work that Gene did to develop that, what we thought was a gold standard in those, and still is. And so I went through and looked at a couple of papers and tried to think, well, where are we now? This is the this was one of the first ones, the residual effect of large applications of pea on high pea fixing soils. And that was Agronomy Journal in 1967. And I know there's some of you who've been working on phosphorus in the audience here that would probably, you know, a younger generation would never be familiar with this paper, because it's not, it can get it electronically now in the digital library, but before it wasn't available. So to a lot of people, it just never existed. And one of the things that kind of bugging me a little bit of late is that we seem to be discovering these new ideas that, hey, there's a legacy, all these large applications are going to fix pea in the soil, or no-till is going to cause some leaching, or it's going to cause stratification, that it's not new. I mean, why are we missing this message? But going back to this is this idea that basically he was a couple of decades ahead of his time. And not to say that he didn't envisage, but I think we've translated this work to a more impact. That's what I'm trying to look at. So the idea was that there was a residual effect of phosphorus on soils, and I'm going to come back to that a little bit later. But the fact that you can apply phosphorus, some would be used by the plant, some would carry over. The old school in those days was you just put money in the bank putting phosphorus in. It doesn't go anywhere, it gets sold. And so this was a kind of a new idea, like you were saying, countering some of the other schools of thought, perhaps in Madison. And so where have we gone with that? This is kind of the legacy where we are now, in terms of, you know, it's newer, but I think it really reflects a lot of what Gene was talking about, that we have the buildup of phosphorus in soil. It takes a lot longer to draw it down than it does to build it up, which is part of the issue that we're struggling with phosphorus, is once you get to that issue that you start to see some increased losses, it's a little bit too late. It's going to take a long time to get back to that situation. But it's also this idea that he was instilling, I guess, in me when he was questioning, when he was probing, and when he was, I thought he was asking questions. Actually, he was getting me to think about some of these things, and getting me to think a little bit broader than where I was going with things, was that there's other things going on. There's a hydrology. So these landscape processes that phosphorus is a resource in the right place, and then once it's in waters, it can become a concern. And so basically, you don't have runoff, you don't really have a problem with phosphorus. So you've got to connect all these dots. We work now trying to work with farmers about soil testing, encouraging them to do soil test phosphorus. But we also know that there's to address some of that, there's conservation practices. We know that now that they don't work straight away, they take time to bed in, basically, and to reach their effectiveness. So there's a lot of different drivers there, and I think Gene's work by building teams was a forerunner for this type of combined larger scale approach of how we deal with this issue now. Just so looking at what's in the farmer's field is only a small piece of the puzzle. Lake Erie, for example, there's a huge amount of pea in Lake Erie in the sediments. There's a huge amount of pea in behind the Conowego Dam, and it's silting up. And those are constantly supplying phosphorus. So we need to be aware of those, that we don't overreact to what farmers are doing now with their fertilizer applications. So that brings us on to this soil testing and how we measure for soil testing. He looked at back in the 70s before we really were getting to work on land manure, but the importance of absorption, the process, the chemistry in soils, and how it was how you could test that to develop fertilizer requirements. And then this is from that book, the Gold Book, the chapter that he wrote on conventional soil and tissue testing for phosphorus. And so taking this as a backdrop, we have transitioned fairly recently, last probably decade, 15 years, to going from soil testing to some of this idea that there's more things that I alluded to earlier than phosphorus. And so this is some of the work that we did in ARS, but it's going back to genes, ideas, and getting you to think that if you just looked at how much phosphorus there was in the soil, relating it to, you know, if our shift has now gone to the water quality. So where do we try and manage these fields? And how do we manage them appropriately? And what we found was this is how much fertilizer is being added. This was strip crops. This is a small watershed near Klingerstown in central Pennsylvania. And what we're trying to do is to find out where the phosphorus is coming from. But basically what we found was you see that most of the phosphorus is coming down near the lower end of that slope. So like he was saying, look at the bigger picture, that just the soil P in itself isn't going to tell you everything. And what it shows is that there's some areas where what we call areas where there's more runoff is going to occur, areas of saturation excess flow. In this case, there was a plow layer below, plow pan below the soil. You didn't know it was there unless you investigated with a soil pit and looked at the profile. Water was moving downslope, hitting that, moving laterally down underneath the ground, and that wet area was down near the bottom. But it showed us that it's kind of counter to where we thought some of the phosphorus might be moving. Again, it fundamentally relates back to what Gene was working on. And part of, I think, what also instilled from Gene was his questioning. We as scientists somehow thought this was new, this kind of a novel idea. You talk to farmers, they already knew this. They already knew that area near the bottom was wet. We don't need to go there. We don't need to apply there. And so a lot of it was, again, this idea that you related to was that Gene was also understanding of the practicalities and the realities of how the science was applied. And sometimes as scientists, we get lost in the detail and we try to work with farmers to become more applied and more practical. And so this led to this idea of these critical source areas. And this, again, it came out in the mid-2000s, 2005, onwards, where we've been able to look at phosphorus management that rather than just from a soil test perspective, but where were these areas, these hot spots? And what it told us was that about 80% of the phosphorus comes from about 20% of the watershed. So if you can target that 20%, or if you can find that 20% area, it's different for different watersheds, you can then effect a greater reduction in nutrient or phosphorus runoff. And that's important if you've got limited funding. So it was a bit of a game changer in a way for EPA to go towards targeted conservation as opposed to a holistic or just a broad brush approach on a watershed. But it was this idea that there's a risk assessment. And again, this is what the tool that's based on soil P content for doing the risk assessment. Most states use Malic, and we've heard that Dr. Kamprath was working with mainly at North Carolina State developing these tests. And what we've done with that legacy is added these other factors into some sort of a risk assessment tool that people have used, that agencies have used, but originally it was intended as a practical tool. I know Gene always wanted to work on the ground, get his feet dirty. But this is mainly was looking at farmers to help them understand the system and help them identify where conservation practices might best be put, or which conservation practice. And so I want to just kind of move on a little bit, kind of coming to kind of a close here. It's some of the work that he did in Brazil with soybeans and fertilizer. It relates back again to these applications, these residual effects, these legacy, and the impact of applying phosphorus. And it, what you said, Jim, right at the beginning was you start to do a Google search of people, probably half the people in this room, you Google search and you come up with a bunch of pictures. Gene, very, very few. He avoided the limelight to an extent. But I was able to get some, and Deanna was very helpful in getting some pictures from. This is one in the Cerrado Savannah in Brazil, where they did some work. And again, you can look at the bottom there, Gene, Stan Buell, Fred Cox, Bob Cate. That's a group of people that were working together. So he was part of this team. Obviously, he had some ideas and some leadership in a certain area, but it was a team and it was a field trip, and that was back in 1971. And so part of that group was Russ Yost, and Russ came back and did a PhD, and I think this is another example I showed you right at the beginning, the effect that if you don't have P in a lot of soil. So in this case, right close to the front there was no phosphorus applied. It's dramatic. You can see the benefit of applying phosphorus to, in this case, corn. And so what he, one of the outcomes before this, there was about 400 million acres of Cerrado Savannah, and I know I'm talking a little bit more about Brazil, and I know Luis is back there, probably more of an expert about this than I am, but you correct me if I'm wrong, but I'll get the numbers off, but they're dominated by oxisols. And there was an FAA report, and I'm looking through some of the documents and some of the reports that Gene had written. And back in 1965, part of the justification for this work was the fact that the FAO had said basically these soils are useless for agriculture. Don't worry about it. Just don't waste your time trying to cultivate these soils. And I guess that was a challenge to these people that I just showed you there in that earlier picture, and to Gene. And what had been happening, about 40 pounds per acre, again, I'm going to use the old English units here, 40 pounds per acre had been applied, and I guess as a soil chemist, it had been absorbed, and quicker than the plant could get at it. And so you weren't really getting a response, and perhaps that's why they were saying these soils are useless. So those soils were taken back. Gene took them back, and then Fred, and then also Russ Yost in his studies, did some work in the lab, some response curves, and they found that 600 pounds per acre, which is a large application, and they basically were looking at starter or a one-time large application, would be good for a response. And that's what, you know, they felt was important. And then I read on. I think this is Brasilia in the background in that rain shower, Luis, right? That Gene said, yeah, okay, but I want to see that total response curve. I want to see how much you can apply and what the response is, where it's going to top out. And so he said, no, that's not good enough. I want you to do this, have a higher application. And what it found was that the 600 was okay. But it was that instilling again with Gene to make you think, to make you do it sound, to make you do it correctly, to make sure that when you did this work, it would stand up to the integrity and scrutiny of anybody else. And I think that's what stands with all of his work that he ever did. But anyway, we went back to the 600, there was support for that. And so what happened after that, this 600 application is initial application, and then following subsequently from that, they were able to apply about £30 per acre of pea per crop and sustain yields, to get the yields that they wanted to get, or that were profitable. And so they overcome that initial hump, and then they were able to be more economically apply this. Sorry, just jumping, it gets sensitive, or else I'm getting jittery here. But this was the work that he published with Rush Yost. You may not see that. Yost, Kamprath, Nederman, and Lerato, that was in the Soil Science America Journal in 1981. But it basically summarized a lot of this work and brought it out there to the larger public. And this is a graph which I put together. And obviously there's a lot of other reasons why soybean yields have increased. But they've increased, the fertilizer applications have increased. But I'd like to think in the back of my mind, I'm pretty damn sure, that a lot of that increase was due to the work that Gene did, because he was able to overcome that that perception that these soils were not profitable, they were useless for agriculture. And so obviously there's breeding and other things, but I still believe this idea that this had to be fundamentally related to what Dr. Kamprath had found in those soils. And then I was fortunate enough to get this from Deanna, and a quote that came out of that that stuck with me, and it's from Stan Buell, who worked with him, who felt that, I'm sure you can all read it, but for those who have followed the agricultural development in the Cerrado district or in Brazil, credit this research as the most significant international achievement in food production. And to me, that's a lasting legacy of what Dr. Kamprath did. He set that seed, he set that wheel in motion, but to me, if I can get something like that, or halfway to that when somebody's giving a symposium about some of the work, I'd be proud. But that is certainly one of the most significant international achievements in food production, and that's basically down to, I see, of what Dr. Kamprath has done. So in closing, I just really want to make it simple and just say thank you, Gene.